Today we're lucky to be joined by Dr. Michelle Lochner from University College London. Welcome to the Jodcast.
Oh, thanks very much, Charlie.
And you're here giving a talk about classifying different types of supernovae with machine learning. So to start everything off, I was wondering if you could go over the types of supernovae that exist and why we want to classify them into different populations in the first place, because there are quite a few of them and they're quite unintuitive.
Sure. Well, so for those who don't know, a supernova is the explosion of a star, and these are the most powerful, most energetic events in the universe. So they're really interesting and exciting to study on their own. Now, over the years, we've found quite a few different types of supernovae, and in fact, we keep finding new ones all the time. And the way they're classified is actually based on their spectrum. So spectrum's a bit like taking a fingerprint, and each supernova has a different fingerprint. So you will hear names like type 1A, 1BC, type 2, and all of these different types just represent what kind of elements we see in the spectrum. So actually they're classified in a very almost non-physical way. It doesn't necessarily have anything to do with what the explosion actually is. But it does turn out that there's a special type of supernova, and that's called the type 1A. Now, we think that this is a very different kind of object from all the other types, which we call core collapse. So I'll explain core collapse first. So core collapse is just when a star gets too massive and it starts running out of fuel and it eventually collapses in on itself and explodes in this massive explosion. Now, there's a different type of supernova, which is these type 1As, which are actually white dwarfs. So these are dead stars, something like what our sun will probably end up like. Smaller stars that have just eventually just run out of fuel and not really done anything particularly interesting. But they happen to have, these 1As happen to have companions, and they accrete matter off of their companion. And eventually, they become massive enough that they explode in a similar kind of way to the core collapse. Now, the special thing about 1As is because they always explode at the same mass, we think that they should be the same kind of brightness. That makes them standard candles. These are really, really precious objects in astronomy because they help us measure distances. If you think about it, if I have, say, a 100-watt light bulb, you can figure out how far away I am by just measuring how bright the light bulb appears. And this works exactly the same way for supernovae. So, for example, in 2011, the Nobel Prize was awarded to the scientists who discovered dark energy, or at least the accelerating expansion of the universe. And they did this using supernovae. So supernovae are really crucial for cosmology, but the other types are also very interesting in terms of their astrophysics. So it's really important to be able to classify between the different types for your different science case.
So type 1A supernovae are the ones that get all the press, and you noted them as the cosmologist's favourite.
Absolutely.
But others are important as well. And you mentioned that had presented a bit of a problem with data collection for different types of supernovae. Could you explain that a little bit?
Yeah, so this is becoming more and more of a problem with these great big upcoming new telescopes. So in the past, what people have done is a supernova will be observed in the optical. So just by taking a few images of it and having a look at the brightness and how that changes with time. Then scientists would have a look at what appeared to be interesting objects that looked the most like 1As and then follow them up spectroscopically. So like I said before, that's a bit like taking a fingerprint. And then you can be really sure you've got the right type. You can look to see if what elements are in the spectrum and you can be sure you've got a 1A. And all the cosmologists cared about were 1As and not the other types. But now we have a much bigger problem. So new surveys are coming online, like the Dark Energy Survey is taking data now, and pretty soon the Large Synoptic Survey Telescope will start taking data. Now, these surveys are going to find thousands of supernovae, perhaps even hundreds of thousands. And the problem is that taking a spectrum is really hard. It takes a lot of telescope time. And so you can't actually follow up thousands of supernovae. There just isn't enough time because these are transient events. They fade away after a couple of weeks. So what we have to do is just using the photometry. So photometry is just when you measure the brightness. So just using that photometry, we have to find a way to automatically classify supernovae. Of course, humans can't do this because A, it's very hard to visually see the difference between the different types. In fact, possibly impossible. but also because there's just too many. You know, there'll just be thousands of them. So this is why machine learning is a really great tool for this, because we can train a machine to automatically classify the different types.
So machine learning, the name implies that you've got to do some teaching. It's not as simple as just feeding it lots of data and getting results out. How does it work?
Yeah, that's right. So, I mean, there are very clever algorithms that can try to automatically find different classes in your data, But they, you know, they tend to not be as good at it as we are. You still need a human element when it comes to machine learning. So what I'm talking about and what I've used in my work is something called supervised learning, which is by far the most common form of machine learning. And that's where you have some training data. So in our case, it would be our spectroscopically confirmed supernovae. So we have some of them, some fraction of the data set that we do actually know the types. And from that, we can label them ourselves and then give that to the machine learning algorithm. It will learn the right pattern to be able to automatically classify new objects that we don't have spectroscopic confirmation of. So that's, and that's the most common type of machine learning. So, you know, for example, Google's image recognition algorithm is very famous. They've been making a lot of progress on it in recent years. But they had to get this massive data set of human classified images. So you had thousands of volunteers going through this and deciding with each image, that's a cat, that's a dog, that's a car, etc. And once you have a big enough training set, then you can train the algorithm to automatically classify things that it hasn't seen before.
And there are lots of different types of algorithm that can be used. They've all got really crazy names. Could you name a few for us? You don't have to go into too many details about
sure.
what they involve. But.
Sure, yeah. There are literally hundreds of algorithms out there. So the oldest and probably most popular and most commonly heard of algorithm is called a neural network. And this was really the first idea behind machine learning. And it's quite cool because it's basically trying to create an algorithm that emulates the brain. So you build a network of neurons that talk to each other and basically do this non-linear operation that takes your input, so whatever your data is, and eventually gives you an output, which would be the class. So neural networks are very popular, and they're kind of making a comeback with this deep learning stuff that everybody's heard about.
Speaking of Google, I've had a look at a piece of software, a very strange piece of software called Google Deep Dream.
That's right.
Which uses the same sort of techniques, generates images based on images that you feed it in. Have you had a play with it?
Yeah, I have. Actually, I wrote a blog about it. It's quite fun. So it's a bit complicated to explain exactly how it works, but it's this incredibly deep, complex neural network called a convolutional neural network that Google uses to classify images. And what they started doing was started feeding the output back into the input and just letting the network iterate and seeing what came up. And
you get these really crazy
images.
Yeah, it's so incredible.
You can so I gave it the CMB, the cosmic microwave background, and I saw what happened to it, and eventually a whole bunch of dogs came out of the image.
I gave it a picture of the Jogcast team, and all the people's faces seem to be replaced with dog faces.
Dogs I think are very popular. Dogs and cats are probably the most common things in the data set.
Is that just because there are lots of dogs and cats on the internet?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think if you give the network something it's never seen before, there's quite a high probability it's going to classify it as a dog or a cat just because it's seen so many of those.
Are there any sort of constraints to using this sort of machine learning for your work?
Sure. I mean, it's one of the biggest problems with using supervised learning is it can't tell you when it's seen something new. Right. So especially for LSST, this Large Synoptic Survey Telescope, we're going to find it's going to have about 10 million transient alerts. So that's 10 million new transients per night. So that's a huge number of objects, and many of those will be things that we probably haven't really seen before. Now, if you use a supervised learning algorithm, it can only classify things based on what it's already seen. It can't classify anything new, so it just simply won't know what it is.
And if it sees something new, will it force a classification, or will discard it?
It has to classify it as something, so it will pick something. Now, there's a couple of diagnostics you could try and use to pick up when that happens, but the algorithm's really not designed to alert you to new things. You have to do something a bit different to do something like that, yeah.
So I guess you're working on fail-safes for things that aren't quite classed in the best way.
Yeah, so I mean, right now, at the moment, we're mostly interested in just getting as reliable a data set as possible classified with the types of supernovae that we know. But for example, we haven't really characterized the core collapse supernovae very well. You know, we have these other types, 1BCs, type 2s, but we don't really have a lot of data on them, at least as cosmologists. So one of the important things is being able to characterize those different types of objects, because things are definitely going to go wrong when we start taking data with LSST.
And we don't have as many not only because there's a bias in observing them, but are they also rarer? Are they rarer events in the first place?
Well, type 1As are brighter. They're intrinsically brighter objects. So if you go to higher redshift, so you're looking back, further back in time and further away, you tend to see more 1As than anything else just because they're intrinsically brighter. So they're more common in that sense. But in terms of supernova rates, the type 2s are a little bit more common.
But because you can observe a larger volume, it sort of balances it out.
Yeah, exactly.
Cool. I was wondering if you could go back very quickly to the LSST. Could you give us a little bit of a spiel on what that's actually going to be?
Where
it's going to be based?
Sure. It's an upcoming telescope. It's a 10-meter class telescope. It'll be built in Chile. It's led by the US, but it's an international consortium. So interestingly, the UK actually just recently bought in as a country, which means any UK astronomer can get involved in LSST if they're interested. It's quite an amazing experiment because it's going to do so many different science cases. So normally we build these instruments, certainly in cosmology, we normally build instruments for a particular task. So like the dark energy survey is very focused on trying to figure out what dark energy is. And, everything is geared towards that. But LSST is going to do everything from near-Earth objects and asteroids and variable stars and all the way to cosmology with weak lensing, supernovae, etc.
So is this telescope, in the same way that the SKA has an iterative design process that's pretty much driven by the science that you want to do?
So the design of the telescope right now is fixed, and it has been designed in order to meet these different science cases, yes. But what's interesting is that the survey strategy is not yet fixed. So it's not, you've got this great big telescope and it's wonderful, but the question is, how do you observe the sky? It's got a very large area of the southern sky that it's going to view. And, the question is, do you come back to a particular patch of sky every night? Do you try to observe quite evenly, in which case you'll only go to a patch every, week or so? So how do you actually observe? And the different science cases actually want different kinds of strategies. So one thing we're doing as a community is working on a white paper to try and figure out what's the sort of optimal strategy that will keep as many different science cases as happy as possible.
And that's a really thick piece of paper.
It is. It's currently 240 pages long.
So back to the machine learning algorithms. How are they performing so far? Are they doing their job correctly?
Oh yeah, we're getting really excellent results with our for this particular problem with this particular data set we're working on. So one of the interesting things we had a look at is the thing that I actually think is the hardest step in machine learning, which is called feature extraction. And now the reason why you need to do this is because it's very rare you can just put raw data into a machine learning algorithm. Most of the time it won't be able to recognize different classes. So what you have to do is extract useful information from your data and give that to the machine learning algorithm. So we looked at 5 different machine learning algorithms and also 3 different ways you could extract features from your supernova data. And we definitely found that some perform much better than others. But overall, we get absolutely brilliant results. Saying that really it's very, very possible to do supernova classification for LSST with just the photometry data.
So what are the 3 different ways that you can classify?
So we looked at, there's one approach, which is the most commonly used approach, which is to fit a model. Now that model is actually built empirically from, a previously measured supernovae. It's called a SALT-2 model. And you can fit those parameters and use those to classify your supernovae. And that works extremely well, which is, already known to be a good way, at least to find 1As specifically. Mm. Another thing you could do is to also fit a model, but instead of using previous supernova data as templates, you could just fit the sort of generic parametric model. So just saying, well, we know what the shape of the light curve is generally. We can write down an equation to define that. And use those parameters as features. That, it turns out, doesn't actually work as well as the other methods. So, it's better to rather use the supernova information you have or to do something completely model independent, which is the third approach, which was a wavelet decomposition. So wavelets are really cool, and they're used a lot in signal processing. It's a way of basically extracting both frequency information from your signal, but also some kind of shape or spatial information from it as well. So you get a lot of information from these wavelets. And they also, we didn't need to use any prior knowledge about supernovae. So that means this is generally applicable to other types of signals, like other transients. And the great thing was the using wavelet coefficients as features works really, really well. It works just as well as the templates. So it's great. Now you've got these two different methods. One relies a lot on what we know about supernovae, but does very well. One doesn't use any previous information whatsoever, and also does very well. So now you have this really great cross-check.
Mm.
And of the five different machine learning algorithms we looked at, there's simple algorithms. I'll throw a few names out without describing them. There's things like Naive Bayes, K-nearest neighbors. Those don't perform that well. But we found good performance from neural networks, things like support vector machines, and excellent performance from these really cool ensemble methods, which are very, very powerful techniques and overall always perform the best.
So you mentioned right way, way back at the beginning that type 1a supernovae are almost identical wherever they are in the universe, purely because of the physical process, which is they get triggered when they hit a certain mass. I'm guessing that means that they're much more likely to fit a template than another type of supernovae where the mass could be variable, the amount of elements, all sorts of things could be different. So do you find that it's easier to, with templates, see the type 1As than to see the type 1Bs?
Yeah, so that's definitely true with the templates about them fitting the 1As much better. And that's what the machine learning algorithm uses to discriminate. It finds that for the core collapse supernovae, that model doesn't fit very well. So the parameters are a bit strange, and it's pretty easy to distinguish between those types. But I wouldn't say that it's necessarily better than, say, wavelets at distinguishing the 1As. Interestingly, there's one particular type of supernova called a 1BC. It's still a core collapse, so it's not one of these white dwarfs accreting matter off a binary, off a companion. But for whatever reason, they do look a lot like 1As. So the 1BCs are usually the things that cause us a lot of problems. And the template fitting approach actually does the best in terms of distinguishing 1BCs from 1As. So maybe there's some more investigation to go into there about different methods being more applicable for different types.
So is the aim to make machine learning better than humans at classifying these sorts of things? Is that the overall goal? Could they ever reach that place?
Well, I mean, for this problem, I would say machine learning algorithms are better than humans at classifying them, right? Because if I showed you two pictures of these light curves, the photometry data from supernovae, you couldn't tell the difference. I couldn't tell the difference. It's very much a statistical thing. It's very much these very subtle differences between the light curves that the machine learning algorithms are picking up that you as a human simply can't. So in this case already, machine learning is better than humans. It's not better than spectroscopic follow-up, that's for sure. If you take a spectrum, then you know for sure what the type of the supernova is. But for this particular problem, it's not something that can be solved by human beings looking at light curves. It's just not one of those problems.
So this doesn't necessarily lend itself to a citizen science project then?
No, for this particular one, I would say not. There are other cases. So citizen science projects are particularly great for image recognition because that is still a really hard problem for machine learning. So although there's a lot of progress going on, of course. So what would be an more interesting citizen science project would probably be trying to classify general transients, perhaps from images or perhaps from other types of data, and especially this problem of trying to find something new, something unusual, something different, because the only way a machine can tell if something is new is if we tell it what defines a new thing, if you understand what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
So we kind of have to know what we're looking for, but we don't always.
While they're smart in incredible ways, they still have to follow rules. And if you don't program the rules, then they don't know what to do.
Exactly.
Mm. So could we go back and ask, what sort of features do you actually use to classify these supernovae then? Is it the overall brightness, for example, or is it the length of the light curve?
So the feature extraction methods that I was talking about with the different model fitting and the wavelet decomposition, those are the things that we use. In the models, they are capturing information like the overall brightness. The most important pieces of information is actually the shape of the light curve, and specifically how that shape changes in different filter bands. So you can observe a supernova in different colors. I mean, these are, for anyone who has a telescope at home, it's exactly like putting filters on your telescopes, the same kind of filters. And that's crucial. Having that color information is absolutely crucial. So LSST is going to have 6 different filters. And really what you're looking for is how that shape changes between the different filters at different times. So you might find early on just after the explosion, one filter is much brighter than another, but then later on the other one takes over. Subtle things like that is what the machine learning algorithm is looking for.
Mm. And when is the LSST going to be up and running? When are you going to expect your first batch of data to analyze?
So I could be wrong with this, but I think it's supposed to be first light in 2020.
And how many supernovae did you say that you were expecting?
That is also a hard question because it depends on the outcome of this observing strategy discussion that we're going on with now. But it's going to be of the order of at least tens of thousands, perhaps hundreds of thousands of good quality usable supernovae.
And how long will it take your algorithms to plow through all of that data?
Well, the algorithms are actually surprisingly fast. So I can, I can analyze a 20,000 object data set in a couple of hours. Of course, I do have access to some pretty good supercomputing requirements. But in comparison with other astronomy projects that might take weeks to run, this is really going to be done in the order of hours, at most 1 or 2 days.
Oh, that's the astronomer's dream, right?
Yeah, I know.
And finally, can I ask, is there any sort of exciting science that you hope to get out of classifying all of these supernovae, for example?
Yeah.
Different amounts of supernovae in each type there are.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I mean, quite apart from the really great cosmology that you can do with the type 1As, there's people who work on supernova physics that I think this huge data set will be invaluable for them because prior to now, we haven't really had very much core collapse data. And there are interesting questions like there's correlations between the type of galaxy, type of supernova, and the host galaxy properties. So you find certain types of supernova in, you know, early type galaxies versus late type galaxies, things like that. So if you've got a really nice big statistical sample, you can start understanding those correlations and start understanding how environment affects supernovae. And the other really interesting science case that I should mention that LSST will be great for is these exotic objects called superluminous supernovae.
Ah.
Now, these were discovered quite recently, and I think there's only of order 10 to 20 that's been found so far. But they are incredibly bright objects. And so you can see them at really high redshifts. You know, you can spot these almost out to redshift 2. And they're really interesting objects. We're not really sure what type of supernova they are. We're not really sure if it's core collapse, if it's something more like a 1A. We don't really understand the variation in the population. We don't understand the rates. And LSST is just going to find a phenomenal number of these. So that will be really interesting, these kind of exotic new objects that we'll understand a lot better with a much larger data set.
Oh, fantastic. Well, thank you very much for joining us today.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much for inviting me.